Our first speaker is Dr. Gregory Gilpin. Dr. Gilpin is an assistant professor at Montana State University and received his PhD from Indiana University back in 2009. Upon graduating, he accepted an offer from Montana State University to teach courses in macroeconomics. He enjoys research and has mainly studied the effects of public policy. His research on public school teachers' labor markets have been published in the prestigious Journal of Public Economics and Economics of Education Review, among others. He's currently studying the ballooning student loan market. Greg, I'd like to thank you for joining us this morning, and the floor is yours. Please take it away.
Thank you. It's great to be here and to be able to give us a small snapshot of the current macroeconomic conditions. In this presentation, I've decided to look at four pillars of macroeconomics, namely GDP, or total output, and how that is in perspective context in our global economy. I'm then going to go on to discuss unemployment and the labor market conditions. Thirdly, I'd like to go over interest rates, short-term and long-term, and inflationary expectations. And lastly, I'm going to close with a discussion of the federal budget. So first off, the U.S. is approximately about $15 trillion. This is about a quarter of world output. So this is going to give us all goods and services that were produced during the last year relative to other countries. You'll also see on this slide that the Eurozone accounts for almost another quarter, and the Eurozone is going to consist of the 17 countries of the European Union. China, they don't produce as much of either of these two groups, but they are growing roughly at a rate of 6 to 8% per year, which is almost triple to about five times what the U.S. produces in any given year. This substantial growth in China has taken about 46% of GDP going towards investment. This is about almost about 2.5 times what the U.S. is going to invest in our own economy. And so they're going to continue to take a substantial amount of input resources to grow at that rate. And in particular, they're going to continue to take a fair amount of energy and raw materials. Other than those three large economies, we've got also Japan and Germany, which have on a per capita basis a substantial amount of GDP and output being produced. Now, for U.S., what we can see primarily is that we've gone through a substantial downturn, and the latest data, which I was very glad that I could present to you today, you can see the substantial downturn that occurred in 08 and into 09, and you can also see the recovery that we've been able to recover. More than 50% of the decline in output from the most recent recession. So the U.S. has rebounded in terms of total output, but it's still going to kind of be persistently sluggish in response to kind of a weak labor market and a weak housing market. The most recent recession was clearly larger than the two previous recessions. So in the table that I presented to you, you can see that the pink bands, that the pink bands are much smaller during the 1990 recession and the 2001 recession compared to our current recession. In terms of duration, we would have to go back at least 50 years, the 1974 recession was somewhat close in terms of duration, at least 50 years for output decline. so as displayed on the graph, output fell rapidly during the most recent recession, but it has been able to rebound. So this rebound took a tremendous amount of government intervention to safeguard even larger drops. Many of the specific programs are now winding down. However, the public policies aimed at safeguarding the overall economy still remain. So now I want to kind of give you some brief numbers on the current state of the economy. We've had some very robust output growth in the last two quarters. In fact, in the third quarter, we are growing about 1.8%. And then in the fourth quarter, we ended up growing at 3%. This was primarily due to consumption increasing, so household consumption. That increased by roughly 2.1% in the fourth quarter. And in particular, durable goods, which increased by about 15.3%. Now, we've also seen a tremendous amount of growth in exports during the fourth quarter. That grew by about 4.3%. And imports, that was only growing by 3.8%. So we kind of had some net exports being positive in the fourth quarter. However, given the last three quarters of imports being larger than exports, the overall year last year was obviously kind of a net export deficit. So I think all of the data is going to indicate that we are in an expansion, however mild. It is kind of forecasted that this expansion will continue, however not as rapidly as we would like or as rapidly as previous recessions. This is mostly attributed to an extremely weak housing market that's not going to see substantial gains for at least another 8 years in many markets and almost up to 18 years in other markets. Now, I'm excluding ag land prices on this, as those are also somewhat determined by commodity prices. I've been able to also get a snapshot of unemployment, and I'd like to just first present the historical trends. Historically, in the U.S., we've been able to have substantially low levels of unemployment. And in fact, after the early 80s, we've had, on average, about 5.5% long-run unemployment rate. We're currently sitting at about 8.3%. Which is quite high for the U.S., but not so high coming out of a recession. So the labor market, it's going to continue to make large gains of roughly 150,000 to 200,000 jobs per month for at least the next 6 months. So it's anticipated that the unemployment rate will go below 8% by November. The data also is going to indicate that unemployment has been persistently high in the most recent recession. So unlike previous recessions where it spiked and it was almost needle-like shaped, we actually have this dull point. So the unemployment rate has been very sluggish relative to other ones. Now, the likelihood of a double-dip recession at this point is quite low, as output and employment numbers are strengthening month after month. In fact, the Federal Reserve, they have just recently, in the last couple days, re-forecasted their employment numbers to a more happy picture. So the U.S. labor supply in the most recent recession has taken, the labor market has taken advantage of the low opportunity cost to obtain skills during the most recent recession. So you can, many universities, you can see many mature students roaming the halls, and other individuals are obtaining additional certifications and upgrading skills, taking advantage of the low opportunity cost to obtain skills. So this is going to continue to change the structure of our economy to more service-driven. In the last 13 months, manufacturing has attributed to roughly 14% of the job gains, and the service sector is almost going to account for the entire the remaining amount of about 86%. Now, the manufacturing numbers, they're going to continue to increase as production lines ramp up their output, and also as more U.S. companies bring their production lines home to the U.S. over the next 3 to 6 years. Lastly, we've had a decline of kind of roughly on average 5,000 to 6,000 government employees every month. I don't suspect that this will continue, you know, over a five-year period, but we are going to see a reduction of the federal government in terms of total employment. It is somewhat good in the sense that government spending is going to directly decrease. Unfortunately, some of these workers are going to go directly into the unemployment insurance line. So, lastly, the individuals who are in the unemployment statistic, what we're seeing that almost 42-43% of those that are in the unemployment statistic have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. So one of the biggest concerns that we have is with the unemployed is that they're unemployed for a longer amount of time, and as they remain out of labor, out of employment, it'll be harder and harder for them to regain entry into a job. That is kind of somewhat demonstrated with the labor force participation rate. So the labor force participation rate, it's going to take a ratio of how many individuals are in the labor force, consisting of those that are employed and those that are unemployed and looking for work, to the total kind of eligible population, which is typically those civilian workforce 16 to 65. As demonstrated on the graph, you can see that we have this inverted U shape, that it rose substantially during the 60s and into the 70s, into the 80s. It's somewhat flatlined during the 90s with a small increase around 1998, and then after 2000, we had our first initial drop, and the first initial drop occurred, and it brought it down from its all-time high of approximately 67%, and it went down to about 66. And now it remained in a steady state there, until around 2008, during the recession, and you can see the decline that occurred during our recession. So we have this substantial drop in the U.S. participation rate. Now, our current participation rate is somewhat equal to that of 1983. So what I get from this data is, while unemployment is falling, we also have to deal with the total amount of participants in the labor force that has declined. Okay. Now I'd like to go on and discuss interest rates. There's a few interest rates that I'd like to go over. I'd like to go over short-term interest rates, and then I'd like to go over long-term interest rates. The federal funds rate is kind of the key short-term interest rate. The federal funds rate is the interbank borrowing rate, and this is directly manipulable by the Federal Reserve by expanding the money supply. The current rate is 0.08. This is sometimes referred to in the media as kind of the lower bound of monetary policy. It is definitely the lower bound, since you can't go below zero on an interest rate for the short run. However, there are other tools to manipulate the loanable funds market. We have been at the lower bound from approximately the beginning of 2009. There was large concern during 2009 when the economy did not respond to a rapidly decline in the interest rate from around 5% per year to zero, that we would enter another recession. However, the economy has taken lift. As displayed on the graph, interest rates have remained extremely low. In fact, we haven't had this duration of low interest rates in the last 55 years. The economy has rebounded, and Ben Bernanke has promised to keep rates low at least until the end of 2014. His rationale is due to a weak recovering economy, and in particular, a weak housing market. This has permitted and will permit many businesses and households to obtain low rates for investment. Given that the cost of producing in China will be on par with the U.S. at the beginning of 2015, some of these low rates is to encourage businesses to reinvest in America and take their companies from producing in China and retooling various factories here in America and bringing those kind of jobs home. The rates are also going to stay low because inflation is not likely to increase in the short run and somewhat in the medium run. So this next slide that I have is on the long-term interest rates. This is on a 10-year treasury bond, and many of the longer-term interest rates are tied into this particular rate. And as the graph shows, that interest rates haven't risen. In fact, we have a steady decline in interest rates from 07. We had a precipitous drop in 09 that recovered. But however, they're certainly at historic lows. So despite the downgrade by the S&P, the U.S. government debt is still considered to be one of the world's safest investments. As the financial crisis hit in 2008, investors bought U.S. government debt, and they continue to do so, especially with the situation in Europe. The recent trends in interest rates also reflect Federal Reserve's quantitative easing policy and the moderate inflation rates experienced in recent years. At any rate, there's no evidence of a flight from U.S. government bonds, at least not to date. Okay. Now, I'd also like to go over expected inflation rates. The expected inflation rate is currently around 3%. There were some concerns that inflation may increase due to lower interest rates. However, given the current excess supply of labor and other factor inputs, prices will remain low. This implies that the Federal Reserve will be able to maintain low interest rates into the near future without substantial risk to an increase in inflation. The impact of the housing bubble continues to be realized with lower asset prices, lower interest payments on housing assets, and lower cost of living for some. With inflation rates remaining low, as well as low interest rates, these imply that the real cost of borrowing will remain low into the near future. However, it also means that holders of long-term debt may desire to hold shorter duration assets. This directly translates into tighter lending standards as financial institutions trade return for better borrowers. Thus, the supply of loanable funds will remain tight. It is suspected that inflation increase will come directly through energy prices and in particular oil prices. This is somewhat out of the control of the U.S. government. While they can promote stability in the Middle East, the market is jumpy and is prone to speculative attacks. Okay. Another measure of inflation that we can get is through the housing price index. One of the most prominent ones is the Case-Shiller Kansas City House Price Index. This graph is clearly going to show the run-up into the housing bubble and then the collapse. This particular graph is indexed for 100 for January 2000. And it also has nominal and real prices. So, first off, we can see that the housing bubble, it primarily started somewhere around the late 90s and early 2000. It grew substantially from 2003 through 2006, and then the bubble started to burst. It didn't burst as rapidly as I would have anticipated, but it had kind of this dull, flat area from roughly 2006 through 2007, and then we saw the rapid decline, and which mostly bottomed, I wouldn't say bottomed out, but lost a lot of its value up until into 2009. After 2009, we had a slight increase. This was mostly from the first-time homebuyer credit, which somewhat buoyed the market. And then you can see after the first-time home market, first-time homebuyer credit expired, you see a slight decline. Housing prices in most markets are not expected in nominal terms to return to the prices of 2006, so about 2020. In some markets, that'll be 2030. Currently, house prices are now less than 5% above their 1990 value. Okay. Lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about the federal government budget. The first number that I'd like to bring out is the federal debt number. This has been in the news in terms of trying to understand how large it is and if we're going, if with Congress debating defaulting last year, we had a downgrade roughly because of the size of our debt. What's important to recognize, though, that we have two measures of debt. The first one is total debt, and this will be the total amount of debt that we have accumulated over time, or gross debt. And we also have the debt that's held by the public, or net debt. The difference between these two numbers is how much do we owe ourselves versus how much we owe others. So total debt is going to include the debt that we owe ourselves and the debt that we owe others, while debt held by public, or net debt, only includes the debt that we owe to other individuals. As the graph demonstrates, we had a large decline from its all-time high post-World War II from until around 1980, and then we had an increase and a continual expansion in growth and net debt. During the most recent recession, we've had a rapid increase in debt from around 60% of GDP to approximately 100% to about 105% of GDP. Now, the graph also shows that the debt is increasing because of the fact that our deficits are expanding faster than our economy. That is, our debt accumulation is faster than our output growth. As a percent of GDP relative to other countries, we are actually not the largest debt holder. Now, in terms of total debt, we certainly are the largest debtor, I should say, with around $15 trillion worth of government debt. However, as a percent of our GDP, in particular net debt, that owed to other people, that owed to other institutions other than ourselves, we're somewhere, I wouldn't say the middle, but we're certainly towards the top, but not the top spot. So Greece has net debt, debt owed to other countries of 142%. They don't have any debt held by any of their own institutions. We also have Portugal, which is around 79%, and Italy, they're around 70, Ireland, 69, Spain is quite low at 48%. However, they're included on this graph because of their other issues with their macroeconomy making it difficult for them to finance their debt. And then we can see the U.S. at roughly 62%. And those are 2010 numbers. One of the big questions one has to ask is, how much debt is too much? And does the U.S. currently have too much debt? So that question is primarily asked when lenders worry if they won't be or willing or able to pay back its debt. So there's two primary ways that that countries may not be able to pay off their debt. The first one would be a default risk, which is when they're not able to make their payments to their debt. And the second one is inflation risk. That occurs when a country prints money to pay off its debt. So governments are going to resort to paying off debt through printing money when they have no other means of a revenue stream through taxation. The point, though, is that the risk, if it occurs due to outright default or through inflation risk, they're the same, because the value of the interest payments are going down on when lenders lose faith. I've got six countries on when lenders lose faith, and this is on the 10-year bond yield. This is just a snapshot from a couple months ago. I've been able to gather together the what the countries are called the PIGS: Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And I wanted to demonstrate primarily where the U.S. stands in terms of interest rates and where they are relative to other countries that are going through financial crises, in a particular debt crisis. So primarily you can see Germany on the far right, and Germany has a very low interest rate of roughly 2%. This corresponds very nicely to the U.S. interest rate. Now, the other countries that are experiencing financial crisis, they have much higher interest rates. So Greece, they have an interest rate of roughly 26%, Portugal 10%, Ireland 8%. So their interest rates are somewhere between 3 to 5 times, or even much larger in the case of Greece, than the U.S. These high interest rates are reflecting mainly default risk, because all the bonds are denominated in euros, and they're not able to inflate away their debt, so there won't be any inflation risk. So we also have wondering if the U.S. has a large amount of debt. And now, in terms of default risk and inflation risk, the U.S. debt is not too much. However, what is clear, though, is that on the U.S. case, we are not including future outlays or promises made to future generations included in the net, in our debt calculation. This is what's mostly concerning on the U.S. side, which is, are we going to be able to sustain the budget that we put forward or promise to future generations? So the Congressional Budget Office continually calculates what's going to happen to revenues and expenditures over typically the next 10 years and over the next 30 years. The graph that I've been able to put together right here primarily shows an expected flat revenue stream of roughly 18%. This has gone down from roughly 2.2%, and it went down from the Bush-era tax cuts. It also went down because of our most recent recession. So we can see in the graph the declines, and then it's anticipated that from roughly 15% of GDP currently, that after we have a full recovery from the recession, that we are going to have revenue as a percent of GDP go back from 15% to 18%. And given, you know, current policy being conducted on raising taxes, it's anticipated that this tax revenue rate will stay at 18%. Now, the projected revenue line is expected to go down as some of our government programs are winding down to help out during the recession, as well as other things like unemployment insurance outlays going down as well after the recovery. Now, this revenue line is not anticipated to go downward for very long. In fact, it's anticipated that total primary spending is going to go above 25% of GDP by 2035. This is going to be mostly attributed to a substantial increase in Medicare and Medicaid payments, the CHIP or S-CHIP payments, which are coming from the government subsidizing low-income households, and Social Security moderately increasing from more baby boomers retiring. Given our current projections, it's quite clear that our debt is not anticipated to fall. In fact, it's clear from the data that we will have larger and larger deficits in the near future without government action. Now, I don't believe that this spending path is sustainable. In fact, I think some of these projections are highlighting the fact that our promises for the future are larger than what we are able and maybe even willing to pay out. So the question then becomes, are we willing to accept, say, a larger tax rate of going from roughly, on average, 18% to 25%? And I think for most Americans, that answer is going to be no, that we're going to want to reduce benefits in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. Now, how do they end up doing that? Well, that's typically done by allowing inflation to erode away Social Security. So that is, instead of doing large cost of living adjustments, we lower those so that through inflation, we're paying out in real terms less and less in terms of benefits towards Social Security in the future. So this is kind of concluding my remarks on this kind of the current state of the macroeconomy. To recap, we have very strong output numbers. We continually have large increases in output. In terms of recovering from our most recent recession, employment growth is occurring. Most of the indicators are quite favorable in terms of overall consumption, durable good consumption. We also have favorable numbers in terms of our export numbers slightly growing. And we also see a return of U.S. companies that have produced abroad back into America. Some of this is being fueled by low interest rates, and I think that the central bank will maintain those low interest rates. And we have favorable conditions for allowing inflation rates, at least in the short run, to remain low and stable. So, John, I'm going to turn the time over to you now.
Okay. Thank you, Greg, for those really great insights. We have time for just a couple of questions from some of our participants, and so we'll take a couple of those now with the idea that we'll follow up with you and our second presenter at the in our closing segment. One of those questions is, what triggers, in your opinion, are most likely to slow or possibly reverse the mild expansion that you described in the current outlook?
The first one that I'd like to highlight is kind of the gridlock in Washington in terms of discussing policies related to the vulnerable funds market, so or even debt. Last year, Congress decided to debate if they were going to raise the debt ceiling, and that primarily was more show than anything. That caused a tremendous amount of anxiety and uncertainty in the financial market. The stock market's increase in volatility, and then the S&P downgraded U.S. debt from its kind of perfect rating. If Washington continues on a path of kind of almost showboating and not getting to kind of the real issues, and in particular issues for which resolution is already anticipated, like we expected to increase the debt ceiling. We're not going to default on U.S. debt. That's clear. Because foreigners, you know, a third of it is owned by foreigners, and we haven't ever defaulted on foreigners owning our debt. Secondly, the housing market is remaining stagnant. So we have some homeowners who they want to see if they can somehow hold on to the houses for them to recover some of the value that they've put into the house. If the housing market remains stubborn in terms of pricing, this could have consequences, longer-term consequences in terms of unemployment and individuals' mobility.
Okay, and clearly timing is very important too, and so any delays or other kinds of uncertainty that they might interject by how they go about acting would really have some potential impact things as well. Our second question is wondering here by this participant if you could rank the importance to the recovery and the whole sort of upswing of the economy of the following factors. And those factors that they listed were interest rates, unemployment, U.S. housing market, foreign economic activity, and then other in general, et cetera.
I think most economists would suggest that labor is our precious resource that we have. And so I would primarily first put unemployment or the employment of individuals. That's important for recovery in terms of goods being produced. And then secondarily, I'd probably put interest rates because that is the driving mechanism for investments. When we have low rates of interest rates, we can get investments, get production lines back online, retooled, get workers back to work. However, I still think that laborers and individuals and their ability to become employed and matched to the best job possible for them is key for recovery.
All right. Well, thank you again for your thoughts. I believe in the interest of time, we should probably move now to our next presenter.